Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast. I'm very excited to have today's guest on the show. Tim Payne is the captain of the Australian cricket team. I'm not sure even Tim Payne thought that he would be ever introduced as captain of the Australian cricket team. In fact, there was a time not so long ago that Tim Payne wasn't even keeping wickets and playing for Tasmania, and he was set to retire from the game of cricket. He was going to take up a job at Kookaburra and move on with the rest of his life. But he was told by some very influential people, and we'll touch on that a little bit in this chat today, that maybe he shouldn't rush that decision. And before he knew it, he was picked in the Australian Test squad. Wasn't even keeping wickets for his own state, was picked in the Australian Test squad. Now, this wasn't the first time that Tim had represented Australia. He had been a gun junior cricketer, played very high level cricket for Tasmania and then for Australia. And then during an exhibition match, a very fast bowler by the name of Dirk Nannis, and I know Dirk, he's a very nice guy, but a very fast bowler by the name of Dirk Nannis had broken his finger. Now, for a wicketkeeper, your finger is a pretty important part of your overall operation. And it took, speaking of operations, it took 6 or 7 different operations over 2 years before Tim had his finger fixed. Obviously, that affected his cricket career in a pretty major way, not just in a physical sense, but in a mental sense. And it was a battle for him to fully recover. Fast forward, and Tim finds himself being picked for the Australian Test team, and then he finds himself in South Africa not long later during the middle of one of the most historic test series of all times. The darkest day in Australian cricket, the sandpaper ball tampering incident. And Tim is keeping wickets during that game, does not really understand in the moment. We speak about that a little bit. I didn't want to go too much over what happened in South Africa because Tim wasn't at the heart of it, and it's very hard when you're captain of Australian cricket team to speak for others. But it was also the moment that he became the accidental captain of the Australian cricket team, the standing captain of the Australian cricket team. So I thought it was important to talk about that so that we could talk about what happened next. Because since then, Tim has established himself as the captain of the Australian cricket team. He has rebuilt the Australian cricket team's reputation both on and off the field, and I imagine agreeing to do interviews like Willosophy is part of that ongoing process. But it was incredible to sit down and talk to him about so many different aspects of his journey and his life. And as usual, I didn't want to necessarily go back over things that have been talked about, you know, 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times. But all of that, of course, is part of the story. So we had to touch on some of it. If you are listening to this on a Sunday on Patreon, which you can do, you can get it a day early, ad-free. And all you have to do is sign up to the Patreon page, patreon.com/willosophy. You can join there for as little as $1 per month. It's basically like a GoFundMe or a subscription, like your Netflix subscription. If you like this podcast, and it means that I can pay podcast mic properly, and it means that I can pay James Fosdyke for the original artwork, and that's where the money for all that, plus a couple of ads that run in the show. But if you don't like the ads, if you don't want to hear the ads, if you're a skip through the ads person, well, we do that for you on the Patreon page. So patreon.com/willosophy. This year, we've been on a bit of a mission to get to $5,000 per month, because that would enable us financially to do 2 shows per week. And the aim is that there would be a brand new show early in the week and there will be a catch-up episode later on in the week. Well, look, we got over the line for about 30 seconds. There was like one day during this year that we got over 5,000, but of course Patreon relies on regular subscribers, so we're back under the 5,000, and we have been for a while now. So basically 1 episode a week still, but here's what I will say. We're in a good position to set ourselves up for 2021. So if by Christmas we could get to $5,000 per month on the Patreon page, we can start 2021. We can say, fuck you, 2020. And we can start 2021 by being able to do a brand new episode early in the week and then a catch-up episode later in the week. So if you would like to hear that in your ears, patreon.com/willosophy is the place to go. I also have a bunch of other shows, tofop.com. So there's Tofop, there's Fofop. They're both coming out weekly at the moment. And then Two Guys, One Cup our AFL adjacent podcast. Charlie and I still need to do an end of season wrap of that, but I've just been pretty busy with my Gruen commitments at the moment. Of course, oh, that is still on. If you want to watch my TV show, it's called Gruen. It's on the ABC. You can watch the first episodes, 7 episodes of the series on ABC iView. They're all up there for free at the moment, and we still have 3 episodes to go. This week is an absolute corker. We're going to talk about Christmas on the show this week, which means there are a bunch of really cool ads, and we're also going to look at the world of privacy and how much data is being sucked up by all the devices that you're using. So it's going to be an absolute corker on Wednesday night if you want to tune in for Gruen, and then 2 more episodes after that up until Christmas. So that's me. Thank you very much for supporting this show, and I really hope that you enjoy not only this interview with Tim Payne, but a very successful summer of cricket for the Australians. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to Philosophy with Will Anderson. I'm Will Anderson from the title of the podcast, and this is how the show starts. I ask the guest who they are. So who are you?
Tim Payne, Australian Test Cricket Captain.
Australian Test Cricket Captain Tim Payne. The first words of the Wikipedia page, the first words perhaps of the tribute that gets paid to you, you know, at the end of your life now. I had Julia Gillard on this show, Tim, and yep. She spoke about the idea that forevermore, the first line of a biography starts with former Australian Prime Minister, first Australian female Prime Minister, and now forevermore, you're Australian cricket captain Tim Payne. Did you ever imagine that they were words that would precede your name?
No, never, to be totally honest. I think from... Yeah, ever since I was as young as I can remember, that my dream was certainly to play cricket for Australia. But at no stage did that involve being the captain, or at any stage did I want to be the captain, to be honest. But yeah, I think maybe when I've finished, it's something that I'm obviously, you know, really humbled and honoured to have the role. But when I look back, maybe it'll mean more to me then. But at the moment, I'm seeing myself as very, very lucky to be doing it. And I'm really actually enjoying it now, which is nice as well.
Well, that's a very encouraging thing to hear, because I've thought about this a lot recently. In times of great crisis, there are those who are drawn to leadership because they believe they are the person who can help, you know. So at the moment with the global pandemic, you're seeing leaders all over the world react in very different ways. But some of them have clearly gone, this is the reason that I wanted to be a politician. This is the reason that I wanted to be a leader. When people needed me, I can be the person who can guide them through. And you certainly came to the Australian cricket job when cricket was in a time of crisis. Did you appreciate the opportunity to be the person who would lead us out of that crisis?
No, I'd be lying if I said I did. I still remember sitting in the change rooms when they said that I was going to be the captain, and I remember my heart sort of sinking a little bit, thinking, Christ, like, can I do this? How do I do this? And do I want to do it? And that's that. Yeah, that was my honestly, that was my gut feel and my instinct straight away. But I sort of told myself basically the way of getting into it was, well, someone has to do it, so why not just try your best and see how it goes? And that was pretty much how it started, really. I didn't have any sort of lots of leadership or captaincy experience or, you know, philosophies on how to do it. No sort of handbook, that's for sure. But I just tried to keep things pretty simple, and so far it's working out okay.
Okay, so this is a podcast. We talk to people about their philosophies, their life philosophies, and you mentioned there that you didn't have a leadership philosophy. Do you now have a leadership philosophy?
Not really. No, I don't. I have a few things that I try to stick to. But I've always found, particularly captaining or leading, it's very much dependent on the group of people that I'm leading. So, I have to captain Tasmania completely differently to the way I have to captain Australia, because the personalities are different, the skill level's different, the pressure's different. And the same again if I captain my club university, or if I'm doing something else and I'm leading a group. I just find that every one and every group is so different that I found it really hard when people say, oh, like, what's your leadership philosophy or what's your leadership style? My style is to be quite fluid with it and try and adapt to the groups and the people that I'm with. A few key things for me have always been to try and be true to myself, to be Tim Payne and try and make decisions that I would normally, not try and make captains as the Australian captain. To try and build relationships and be closer to people so I can understand how they work. And then to lead by example as a sportsman in particular with my work ethic and the way I hold myself in public. And if that's a philosophy, then that's probably it. But as I said, I try and adapt and change and learn. And I find if you have a really set philosophy, it almost sounds like you think you know everything. And I've made mistakes as the Australian captain. I'm going to make more going forward. But it's about learning from them and continually getting better, I guess.
Can you tell us about a mistake you've made? Can you tell us about something you can identify as saying, I thought this was going to be the right approach, but it turns out it wasn't the right approach?
Yeah, I've made certainly even ones like at the toss when I had other people saying bat. I've bowled in the fifth test in England. That was one. I made a few blunders certainly in the third Ashes test with the fields I set to Ben Stokes. In that, you know, what ended up being a legendary test match. So I have to rewatch it all the time, which really annoys me. But now looking back, they were key moments in how I'll go about it differently next time. And the Stokes one in particular, like even we had to rewatch that whole last 2 hours the next day. And when I was withdrawn from the high pressure situation of it, or where I was in the middle, to sitting back and watching, it was plain as day to me what I'd done wrong, and just goes to show how your thinking and your judgment can be clouded when you're under that sort of intense pressure. And there's been things, you know, off the field in certain times as well that I should have been better at and didn't. But again, it's all learning. I think that's where my leadership style, if you like, has come from, is a bit of life experience. And I've been a professional cricketer now for nearly 20 years. So I've had lots of different leaders, coaches, captains, and I've sort of just taken bits that I like from each of them and then made mistakes and, as I said, try to get better from those mistakes.
I'm super interested, though, in this idea that you say when you step back from it, when you watch it from a distance, those things were very apparent to you. And, of course, for those who aren't cricket fans who are listening to this, and hopefully there's some regular people who listen to the show who've tuned in and might not be across the game of cricket, they might not understand that not only are you the captain of the Australian cricket team, but you're also the wicketkeeper. And in cricket, that is the player who most traditionally is involved in probably as much of the game as anybody else. So when you talk about not being able to step back, being slap bang in the middle of it, what do you do going forward to be able to do that while you're in the middle of the game, when you're still concentrating on the fact that, you know, Pat Cummins is, you know, bowling a ball down very quickly and you've got to see which edge it's going to come off and which direction you're going to have to dive to try to stop the ball? How do you, in the midst of all that, take an opportunity to step back and see the game from not in the heart of it?
I think for me, it's actually realising, again, it's like a lot of things, you've got a lot more time than you think, particularly in cricket. So I've got some time in between balls, particularly when a fastball is bowling, where I can actually just almost at times even shut my eyes, take a deep breath, remind myself of what we're trying to do, how we're trying to bowl to a certain batter, what our processes on in a certain session or a certain day. And at times you can get caught up in the speed and in the crowd and in the pressure and in the result rather than what are we actually trying to execute here. And so for me as a captain as well, at times the other thing that's come with experience for me is empathy. So I now have to remind myself constantly that, you know, Pat Cummins didn't just run in and try and bowl that ball so he got hit for four. He's running in trying his absolute best, like I am, but in the heat of the battle, you can get angry and think, what the f*** is he doing? You know, why isn't he doing this? We spoke about doing this. And, you know, pressure does funny things, and it's a very hard game, cricket, at the international level. So for me to be able to take a step back, take in the moment a bit more, and as I said, have a bit more empathy for other people and what they're going through, has allowed me to just focus, as I said, on what we're trying to achieve that session or that over or that ball.
So I'm interested in power dynamics and how they apply to leadership as well, because when you go play for your club team, chances are, I imagine, you're probably the best player who's playing in that team. And, you know, even when you're playing for Tasmania, there will have been periods of your career where, you know, you were the gun, or you were amongst the handful of guns who are playing in that team.
Yeah.
And then you transition to the Australian cricket team, where the previous captain has been, you know, maybe even the best cricketer in the world, let alone the best cricketer in the team.
Yeah.
And you don't fit, you know, in that same level of the power structure.
Yep.
Does the power dynamic affect the way you lead?
Not for me. I think, again, I've looked at that as a real strength. I find that it actually makes me probably more relatable to our players at all levels of our players, whether that's Tasmania or Australia. And at times, I also feel maybe the opposition probably underestimate me, not as a player, but maybe as a leader and my influence on our group and how positive that can be, sort of thing. So I think normally what can happen is if we get on top of a Virat Kohli or you know, their captain and their best player, that is a huge drain on their team, because one, their best player is not performing, and two, he's then maybe worried about his own form and his own performances, so then he's not the captain and the leader that he should be. So for me, I don't think they ever come in and say, geez, we want to take Tim Payne down. He's such a key player for them. They're worried about Warner. They're worried about Smith. They're worried about Marnus. They're worried about Cummins. And I can fly under the radar that way, which then actually allows me to be really level and really consistent with my leadership.
I'm very interested you mentioned Virat Kohli, and I'm always fascinated because he's announced that he will play, I believe, in the first test of the series, but then he's got to go home because he's having a baby.
And that's what I'm hearing.
So when you hear news like that, I'm very interested. I mean, I know, like, I guess there's one perspective, which is, you know, we want to be the best. We want to play against the best. And you want to go out there and play against the other team at their full strength and try to beat them at their full strength. But is there another part of you that when you hear he's going home, he's secretly happy about it?
Absolutely. It's not even secret. I am wrapped. That will, you know, I mean, they'll have, no doubt they'll have other players. We know how talented they are and they'll step up. But at the end of the day, they're not him. And he is literally one of the best players we've ever seen. So the headaches that he causes a team, and the worry at night and the lack of sleep and in the lunch break when he's in, it's like, how are we going to get this bloke out? He is just extraordinarily good. So you take him out of their team, of course it's going to make a difference, like it did when we played them last time and we had no Smith and no Warner. It clearly makes a huge difference. But that doesn't guarantee us success against them either.
It's external observation and not something that you can probably say or acknowledge yourself. But it seems to me that, you know, your leadership of the Australian cricket team is, you know, come the moment, come the man. You know, that funnily enough, you were made exactly for these times. You're the leader that we need in these times. I can't see anyone else in that team that could have burdened the responsibility of having to go through the period we went through in Australian cricket and come out the other side and, you know, wear the blows and knocks and setbacks that would come inevitably with this. And yet you were about to retire from the game. It's such an incredible story to me that, you know, the greatest achievement in your cricket life, which will be this period of time. And now you'll be remembered not as the accidental captain of the Australian cricket team, but, you know, a guy who had a substantial record, you know, captaining the Australian cricket team over a good period of time and, you know, has brought great pride and admiration back to the Australian cricket team that had been lost in such a huge way. It's incredible. It's an incredible moment in your life. And there must be times, certainly from the outside, when I look at it and think, wow, this was what it was all about. You wouldn't have known it when you had a broken finger. You wouldn't have known it when you were a kid playing in the backyard. But there was a real reason for you to, you know, pick up a cricket bat and pick up the gloves and play this game. And it feels like we are in this moment.
Yeah, no, certainly. And as I said, I sort of touched on my life experiences before, but I now look back at like the times where I was really struggling, whether it was form, whether it was injury. I had a period of time when I couldn't even get a game for Tasmania. It was only 4 years ago. And mentally I was absolutely nowhere as a cricketer. And again, those life lessons really sort of humbled me. And then I think, you know, just by fate or however it's happened, you're right, it's sort of when I became the captain of Australia, without realising it, I was probably ready for the role in a different way than other captains have been ready. I mean, your Ricky Ponnings and your Michael Clarks are sort of, they were born and destined the moment they started playing cricket for Australia. That was going to happen. Yeah, my journey has been completely different. But again, maybe suited the time for what was needed. And again, I think that another huge positive, which people don't see, is the fact that I live in Tasmania, which is, so I am outside of the media mainstream bubble and the higher pressure that sort of comes with that. I get to come home and people still treat me exactly the same. They couldn't care less if I'm the Australian Test captain. They know me. They know my family from being around sports in Tasmania for a long time. And but again, to be able to come back, get out of the spotlight, be treated as exactly how I was before I was Test captain, again, is really grounding and probably, again, one of the real strengths of being living in Tasmania is giving me a different dynamic, I guess, or a different look at it.
And that's not something that you've considered changing. You've obviously decided you like going back to Tasmania. You're not signing up for moving to Sydney and living in Bondi.
Absolutely
and,
not.
Partying at the Ivy with Buddy Franklin or something like that.
No, that's not up my alley anymore anyway. I couldn't ever see myself living anywhere else. Even now in Hobart, I'm start to get slightly frustrated with the traffic. And I mean, I have to drive from my house to Belrive once a day and it takes me about 9 minutes. If it takes me longer than 10, I'm furious. I'm blowing up about traffic lights. And so I love going to all the bigger cities around the world that I get to travel with cricket, but only on holiday. I couldn't see myself living. I'm not a huge fan of big crowds. And, you know, even if I want to go out for dinner or a bar or a pub, I like it a bit smaller, a bit more Hobart like. I don't like going to big crowds. I get a bit anxious even before I was the captain. It doesn't sit well with me.
So there are so many aspects, as you touched on, about being the captain. One of them is your performance on the cricket field. And I think that, you know, obviously what other people saw in you was the idea that you would be right at that level. That they didn't necessarily need to see, you know, you'd be, you know, even playing at that certain level, at the next level down. They just had a faith that when you stepped up to the big end of town that you would be fine again in the big end of town. And clearly you'd had experience there before. It wasn't, you know, your first time there. But where did that come from? And do you think about the idea that some people had faith in you? Unreasonable faith in some ways.
Oh, a huge amount of faith. To the flack that they would have copped that if this didn't go well, when I just came back into the team, so it was sort of pretty much, it was Darren Lehman, Greg Chappell, Steve Smith, and Brad Haddon, who was an assistant coach behind the scenes then. And what I think the story I'm sort of put together now is that they were looking, you know, they knew how good their attack was. They thought to win the Ashes in Australia, they needed to take every single chance they created. And I think for a while the belief was that I was probably the best wicket keeper in Australia. I just hadn't scored the runs, and sort of post Adam Gilchrist, we'd gone in that direction where it was like batting first, keeping second. So I think Greg sort of pushed that back. Let's get the best wicket keeper in Australia. Oh, who do we think it is? Tim Payne. Geez, we can't pick him. He's not getting a game for Tasmania. So they took a really extraordinary step of picking me in that Cricket Australia at 11. To play against England. It was sold to me as you're a senior player around the States, even though you're not playing. Can you go and look after some of the young guys, teach them some things from around you, from your experiences? Little did I know then they were actually just building me up to be ready. So yeah, I owe those four in particular a hell of a lot for taking a punt on me. Yeah, and then I think probably, again, it was a perfect storm. I'd been through so much. The second chance I got to Test cricket, I sort of released the pressure on myself and promised myself that I would just enjoy it. And probably 90% of the time I've been able to do that, which is which is really cool. I've been able to take it in as well and actually sort of stand out in the ground at times and go, this is just amazing. I cannot believe I'm here, let alone the captain. I just can't believe I'm playing in Ashes Test and we're about to retain it or win them like we did in Australia or You know, win 5 test matches in a row last summer and be standing in the middle of the MCG. It's just, yeah, it's the stuff of dreams. And the first time I was doing it, I didn't treat it like that. I took it for, didn't take it for granted, but everything, I was in a rush. I always wanted more. I always wanted the next thing. And the second stint I've had at international cricket, it feels like it's been going for about 20 years and it's been going for nearly 3 because I've just taken it all in and just tried to enjoy the moment and long may it continue.
So connection to performance in enjoyment is something that I'm super interested in because you do see those players who, at whatever sport they tend to play, and even in my industry, you know, comedians who just can get in a zone where they're having as much fun as the audience who are watching them are having.
Yeah.
Is there a sense of that? Can you have a sense of that on a cricket field where you're just genuinely enjoying it as much as everybody else?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, from my own experience, I find that I only really get that wicket keeping. Mm. I've never mastered batting.
Right.
I feel like there's been times in my cricket career though where my wicket keeping, I feel like I'm watching myself, and I'm sure that's what Steve Smith and Virat Kohli feel like with the bat. I like sometimes when I used to play Shield games and Tassie would win the toss and bat, I would be like, oh no, I'm gonna have to bat today. Christ, what am I going to do? I've got no idea. Whereas when we won the toss and we were bowling, I was like, oh, beauty. And even my talk around the group was like, you know, like I feel like sometimes when I'm wicket keeping I'm not a sort of show off person, but I feel like sometimes it's like a discreet way of showing off. Like I like to show people how good I can actually be as a wicket keeper, and I take balls and do stuff and I kind of smile to myself like, geez, that was a good take. And that's when I think I'm in the zone. It's a really relaxed but enjoying type of thing, and unfortunately or fortunately, whatever, I never quite got there with my batting. So again, with my batting, I've just let go now. Justin Lang has been unbelievable for me for that, and I'm starting to enjoy it. I don't enjoy it in the fact that, geez, I'm mastering this like I do sometimes with wicket keeping, but I just try and have fun and try and contribute to the team when I bat.
So talk to me about the relationship with Justin Langer, because I was such a great admirer of him as a cricketer. I just, for whatever reason, you know, when you feel predisposed to watching somebody play, he was always a favourite of mine. I just thought that, you know, he might not have been quite as skilled, although he was excellently skilled as the rest of them, but you knew that he was going to make the most of the opportunity that he has been given. And I think as an Australian coach, at least the perception from the outside is that he wants the same of everybody else. What is that relationship like between you and him?
Yeah, it's brilliant. I met JL a long time ago, so which people I don't think know. I think some people thought we were sort of captain and coach put together and then we've gone. But when I was first in the Australian setup, when I was sort of 23 to 26, Justin was the assistant coach. And I was on tours all the time as the backup wicketkeeper. So when you're a backup keeper on a cricket tour, you basically need to get out of the way when the other boys train. So JL and I would go to the gym in the morning together with our fitness guy, get it done, go and have some breakfast. Then we'd go down to the ground much earlier than the others. That's where I'd get my batting and keeping done with him. So, you know, I did that for a whole World Cup and a couple of one-day series. And we just sort of hit it off. And I, like you as well, I loved the way he used to play. I'd heard stories about how hard he trained, how he was a bit scary at times. And then when I met him, you can tell he's got that hard, really hard, hard-working, hard man. Can be scary, spraying him as well. But the other side of him is this really caring, soft, gentle person. And, so I sort of knew that side of him before some of the other guys. So I don't find him as scary as some people do. And he likes to play that up, JL, too, sometimes. But, yeah, I just find him now like a really good mix of... And again, he's got to know the players now, so he can be really hard, firm and direct with us and with me in particular, but I know through the other side of him that I know that it's always coming from a really good place and he wants nothing but the best for all of us. I think that's his strength. He still can be very, very hard and direct, but he's got that sort of fatherly figure as well. So it's a really nice mix.
What's the best way that you receive feedback? Because professional sports people, I'm always incredibly fascinated by, because, you know, artists, you know, the people that I grew up with, you know, very, very sensitive to feedback. It's fair to say, Tim, but professional sports people have to get it all the time. How are you at receiving feedback, and what way do you like to get it?
I like it just direct. I mean, you like, no one likes to be abused, do they? But I just like to be told. I want to know what you want from me, and I'll try and do it. I'm the same now with captaining. I find that the younger the players, the harder it is, or the nicer you have to be. So there's a real balancing act between keeping them happy and on side, but also giving them the direct feedback that you need. But again, because I had the relationship with JL earlier, it certainly makes it easier for us to have those tough conversations when we need to. And then I think people who, you read stuff in the paper and commentators and all that sort of stuff, that stuff I used to hate. And then the second time I came back international, I could not care less. I think I've got to that point where I realize, and I've done a bit of commentary myself last year, so I sort of saw the other side of the fence and realised that it's not personal. They are doing their job in commentating on me as a captain or me as a cricketer. They're not having a crack at me as a person, or it's never a personal thing. It is purely on the job you're doing as a wicketkeeper, as a captain. So I remember when people would say, "Oh, Tim Payne's no good, he's this," I'd be like, that's it, I'm never talking to that journalist again. Whereas now it actually doesn't bother me. And funnily enough, since I've been like that, I've probably been nicer to them, so now they tend not to. So it's kind of, it's gone full circle. But yeah, I mean, I like it direct, because I don't want to mess around. I don't want to be wasting time either. And I don't take anything personally, so it makes it easier.
So you talk about external noise, and it's hard to... I'm sure there'll be a time that people can speak to you and not speak about what happened in South Africa. And I hope that is, you know, soon, and it'll be a big relief for you. But unfortunately, today is not going to be that day. Because I was one of those people who really felt it.
Yeah.
I felt it disproportionately to... I don't know why. I was raised on cricket.
Yeah.
I love the game of cricket. Never had any talent for it myself, but something that my father and I both share a love for, and it's something that we can talk about and that we can enjoy together. And it had a very ethical background, or at least reputation in our family. You know, my dad was very much, you know, I remember being little and he's sitting me down and making me read Don Bradman's book and telling me that Don Bradman didn't need to hit him in the air hit him along here. And, you know, very traditionally sort of, you know, cricket morals, right? Old school. Yeah. And so when what happened in South Africa happened with the ball tampering, I was one of those people who felt really, really, really deeply hurt by what had happened.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I can't really explain to you why.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was one of those people. And it felt like a massive betrayal.
Yeah.
When you're in the middle of it, in the eye of that storm, because now that I've had time to look at it from, like you said, step back.
Yeah.
And have an opportunity to, I was like, geez, you know, the crowds had been pretty tough over there. Ball tampering is a fine line at the best of time in cricket around the world. Like similar things have happened and they've resulted in, you know, one or two match suspensions, if that. You know, that's the context of the world.
Yeah.
So when it happens, were you aware at all that it was going to be as big a deal as it obviously ended up being?
Not at all. That was probably the shocking part for me. I still remember when it sort of came up on the screen and Smithy was just like beside himself effectively. And I was like, it's all right, mate. It happens all the time. Just relax. Make sure we get the rest of this day. You know, let's concentrate on that. Like we needed him to be, you know, making the right decisions that day. And he, to his credit, sort of picked up straight away. He was like, nah, this is going to be huge. And I was like, mate, everyone gets done. People have been done hundreds of times, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so I sort of went home naively that night thinking, oh, it'll be reasonably big. Mm. But boy, when I woke up the next morning and obviously it had gone back to Australia, my phone, my Twitter, just everything news was just... I remember just feeling physically sick for like, and it lasted for days. Yeah, that was a bloody hard time. I'd hate to think, you know, what they were going through, those three guys in particular who were copping the absolute brunt of it. But yeah, it was just anyone who was there will tell you that was one of the lowest points of, you know, not only our cricket careers, but probably of our lives. And yeah, the sheer shock of how big that was and how badly Australians took it. Yeah, put in perspective how important the Australian Test team is to people, how important our cricket in our country is, and how important the way we play is as well. I think we got to the stage where we thought if we were winning, they would love us, and that would be it. And probably the biggest takeaway from that was that there's more to it than that. Yes, they want us to win, but you know, we're a direct representation of our country, and people expect us to behave and play in that manner. So that was probably the biggest takeaway, and something that I know JL and myself and everyone else has been involved in the last 2 years is really proud of, the way we've sort of got back to that sort of essence of playing cricket for our country and trying to represent Australia the best way we possibly can.
Yeah, and in it there was a message, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely what you've said, which is we care about this more than just about the result of the games.
Yeah.
There is something more to why the captain of the Australian cricket team, you know, they often say is, you know, you got the Prime Minister or the captain of the Australian cricket team, the two big positions in Australian culture. And that's not because cricket is the most popular game necessarily or in the world. You know, it's because we choose. We take a lot of pride out of, you know, this team and their achievements, but also the way they play the game. So when you're going through a period of time like that, where suddenly, you know, you are reliving your boyhood dream. You're back in the Australian Test team. Like, you know, wow, I was going to retire. I was going to go and work at Kookaburra. Here I am playing cricket for Australia again. And now I've gone from being in something that is like incredibly desirable to being something that is being shunned in popular culture, in news magazines. Like, you know, talk about journalists writing bad things about you. You know, everyone in that team copped it to a certain extent.
Absolutely.
And now... and now you're in charge.
Yeah.
So, like, when you have to start rebuilding something like that, you know, what is it that you and Justin Langer start with?
I think just some clear direction. And we spoke about stuff like that. So we spoke about the fact that I think internally, and international cricket is such a little bubble that I think we started to think that we were the be-all and end-all, and we only thought of ourselves. And that wasn't in a bad way. I just think you get caught up in next series, next game. Everything is about winning. And if we don't win, we get absolutely nailed. And I think that sort of mentality meant it became a bit of us against everyone else. And we probably forgot the fact that, again, it's not our team. It's Australia's team. And you hear us talk about that a lot now. I think we started to think that it was us, and this is our team, not Australia's team, and it's about me. It's not about you or them or our fans. It was about me, and what can I do to get the best for myself? So we just turned it around into, you know, we want to be a cricket team that, one, puts the team first, two, makes Australians proud, and JL talks about it all the time. We want to be making great cricketers, absolutely, and we want to be winning. But what's just as important is that we keep producing great Australians and great people. And he's really strong on that as well. So it's not like something that we do for a few weeks. We constantly check in with, you know, how are we going in that space? Is our behaviour at a level that we expect? Are we looking after each other? Are we playing for the team? Whereas I think maybe in the past we had some words around our team, but we didn't really revisit it and check along like we would with our game plan. How are we batting? How are we bowling? How are we fielding? How are we going with our behaviour? How are we going with our culture? How are we going with how people are perceiving us as a group? And we get that feedback now. You know, every start of every tour, we go through it, talk about it, see where we can improve, say what we're doing well. But I think just the revisiting of it, keeping it fresh in our minds, stopping some little things that might be creeping in, but also using it in a way to say, geez, Will, you're doing that great. that's been awesome because people love that feedback as well. It's not always about, it's not having things that we want to pull people up for. It's about rewarding, you know, the right type of behaviour as well.
Who do you talk to personally during a time like that? I mean, obviously you talk to Justin in a professional sense, yeah, in a team sense, but who, when you're going through a dark period like that,
yeah,
becomes your sounding board?
I've probably got a few. I've got Tim Coyle down here in Tasmania, who was my coach. My sort of professional cricket career married his professional coaching career. So Coyle was Tassie under 15 coach when I was playing under 15s. Then he became the manager of our whole state junior program when I went through the 17s and 19s. Then he did some second 11 coaching when I was playing second 11. And then literally probably the second or third year I was on state contract, he became Tasmania's senior coach. And we ended up having, you know, 8 or 10 year period of real success down here in Tassie. So he's known me since I was, you know, 12 years old. He knows how I work, how I operate. He can pick up straight away if I'm moody or I'm too high or, you know, pretty happy with myself or whatever it might be. So he's someone who's, again, I've got a great relationship with, so he can hit me straight between the eyes really quickly. Yeah, and I think, again, just the closeness of our relationships allows him to, one, pick it up quickly, whether it's good or bad, and two, ring me and let me have it. But he's certainly one. I speak to Stephen Day, Major General Stephen Day, a little bit about leadership and trying to gel groups together. Or, you know, he's just great to talk to about anything, really. So he's another one that I use. And then purely on cricket captaincy, I speak to Ricky all the time if I need to know, you know, what do you think about this field or whatever. And obviously I speak to him generally about other stuff, but he's certainly my go-to in terms of cricket captaincy. Stephen Day is someone I use for leadership and experience, I suppose. And Coyley's the one who knows me really, really well, so he can pick up things pretty quickly with me.
Do you have mental health practices that you use in a, like in a training sense, in a regular sense?
Not really. I had a period where I did. When I were touching on it earlier, when I was sort of not getting game for Tasmania, I had no idea. Like I just lost it. I lost my way as a cricketer. I was still really, I was fine as a person. It's just like, I didn't want to go to cricket training. I didn't want to play. But if it wasn't cricket, it wasn't like I was depressed or anything like that. It was like a performance anxiety or the fact that I thought, geez, my career's coming to an end. Like I would do anything I could to get out of having to play or train. And as soon as that was happening and it's like, oh, no, he doesn't have to play, I was fine. So it wasn't like I was, it was similar to a sort of mental health issue or a performance issue, but yeah, the best thing I did was we actually had a female in Taz cricket called Emma Harris, who, she won't mind me saying, had no idea about cricket. And I think it was actually an absolute blessing in disguise, because at that stage I wasn't going to go to my coach or my chairman of selectors and say, geez, I'm struggling, I don't know. Like I was getting out in the middle and just freezing. I couldn't move my feet. I'd be thinking, don't play this shot, and all I'd do was play that shot. It was like I had no control of my mind or my body when a game started. And I'd never told anyone that. I was just like, oh, I'll be all right, I just need a bit of luck. Or, you know, I'll keep training hard and it'll come. And then I was just sitting downstairs having a coffee one day and she happened to come through the room and no one else was there, and I just told her. I don't even know how it sort of got to that stage, and I still remember this day walking out of that room and instantly feeling better, because I'd actually admitted that there was something wrong. And as I've sort of, my thing is now, if you can't admit you got something wrong, you're not going to be able to fix it or map out a plan to fix it. So that was the biggest thing for me, was talking to someone, telling her exactly how I felt. Maybe because she had no idea about cricket, I felt like it was a safe place. And then I just worked with her for 2-3 years. She checked in, still talk to her occasionally now. She's in a different job. But, yeah, she really helped me put things in place, as I would as a cricketer, for my batting or my wicket-keeping. And we just followed it and slowly built it back up. And, yeah, thankfully it came good.
You touched on the relationship between work and life. So you said you were going through this period of professional anxiety, but yep, it wasn't leaking into your life? Are you someone who has a clear demarcation between those two things, or the way you play cricket, does it affect the way you are at home?
It does at times, and it'll depend on the series. And like if I'm playing Shield cricket, I'm probably slightly more relaxed at home than I am if I'm in the middle of an Ashes series. At times, I think it's like everyone, at times it gets you down, and it doesn't get you down, but it gets on top of you. And I'll have times where I come home and my wife Bonnie's, she knows now though, like not knows like, oh geez, you're allowed to be a prick or anything, but she'll know that I'm just probably going to sit on the couch and be pretty quiet. And, mm-hmm. and if she asks you questions, she might get a grunt and a, but early on that quite affected her. And she was like, you know, it's rude, or it's, you know, whatever, you know, like I was ignoring her. She now knows that that's not the case. It's just that I'm probably deep in thought, or I'm distracted by something else. So the one thing that gave me no choice but to separate them both was having kids. So I come home, and if my 2-year-old's done a poo in his nappy, I have to change it. Or if he's crying, I need to help him. And the same with my daughter. If she wants to read a book, or they've been the greatest sort of blessing in a number of ways for me. Really, I can now separate the game, whereas before I really struggled to do so. Whereas I feel like Bonnie, my wife, she'll be right, I just need to do this tonight. Whereas the kids, you just can't. I have to come home, I have to be their dad, I have to feed them, dress them. And then I sort of get into a bit of a role, and I haven't thought about cricket for 20 minutes, and it's good. So that's probably been another key factor in the turnaround of how I sort of view cricket. I'm still fiercely competitive and want to succeed and win all the time, but it's become much more of a game for me.
And so that's, I think, probably the hardest thing for people to get their heads around is this idea that, because it is just a game. I mean, a sport is just a game, but it's a game that we have decided is super important, and there are big businesses built around that game. You know, for a lot of people, it isn't just a game.
Yeah.
But it is just a game. So how do you balance those two things so that you can take it seriously enough but not too seriously? Because that's what it keeps sounding like you're saying to me is that you have found a balance between, I am taking this exactly as seriously as it needs to be taken, but no more seriously.
Honestly, I've only got there through experience again, and my life circumstances changing. So like I now try and help, particularly but here in Tasmania, I try and help guys that are younger than me and going through what I was probably going through 10 years ago, see that it is just a game, and there is huge financial reward for people, but not to get caught up in that and to realise how you work best and then be able to stick to that. So, again, I think people change when, you know, contracts are on the line and team, your spot's on the line, and you start to be very insular and focus on what you need to do. My experiences have always been, if I'm thinking more about the team and how I can help other people around me be better, then that then makes me a better player and a better person as well, and makes me more valuable to my team. So it's such a difficult balance, because you're right, it is a game, but for us, it's our career. And it is such a brilliant life to live. So you don't want to lose it. So when guys are going through a thing, it's like, geez, mate, I don't mind getting up at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning and going and hitting a couple of hundred balls and then going and having coffee and lunch with my mates. That's a pretty bloody good life, and earn good money doing it. So there's that draw as well. And you just get so desperate to stay in it that, you know, guys put too much pressure on themselves. They try too hard. They train too hard. They're tired mentally and physically. So yeah, everyone's different, but it's about trying to find what is your balance. It's not what my balance isn't going to work with someone else. Like we've got guys who like doing heaps of extra stuff outside of cricket and studying or working part-time. Whereas I spoke to Marnus Labuschagne even 2 months ago, and he's like, you know, everyone's always saying to me, you need something else outside of the game. And he's like, no, I can't. For me to be successful, I need to lock in 100% all of my time to cricket, and I'll worry about the rest later. That's kind of how his mind works, and that's great. He understands that, and now he's obviously blossoming. But he, I think, had a period where he was trying to like work or trying to impress Cricket Queensland, wanting him to do more outside of cricket, and he's like, that's just not how I work. But we got other guys who want to go fishing twice a week or play golf all the time and get their mind off it. It's about finding what that is and sticking to it.
So what was that for you? you know, obviously now it seems to be family that's filling that role. But what was that before family?
Yeah, so the other time I was actually a really good cricketer was when I was younger.
Yeah.
And I was either – I was on contract and at school, or I was on contract and Coyley again made me, through a person he knew at the Commonwealth Bank, made me get a job. So I was a teller at the Commonwealth Bank Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 8 till 12. And just that little bit of sort of real life and having to go to work, one, just kept me a bit more rounded and gave me some skills for after cricket, but it also made me appreciate my time at cricket a lot more. And when I was there, I really made it count because I knew I had to get back to work or I had to go to school. So it made my training higher quality, made my stuff shorter and sharper, and I loved being there because I'd come from work, which I hated. So when I got to cricket, it's like, oh. So it made me appreciate it. Then the money started to become better and I started to play games for Australia. I was like, oh, I don't need that anymore. I'm good. And then it slowly just snowballed. And again, everything became cricket and cricket related. And I started to think that people only want to talk to me because I am the cricketer. If I'm shit at cricket, are they still going to want to... You start to have all those kind of thoughts. And then, it just snowballed from there. And, you know, 3-4 years later, I couldn't get a game for Tasmania. And then what's happened's happened. And I have kids and I've got married and I've got other stuff going on. And I'm playing the most high-pressured cricket that I've ever played right now. And I've never had more fun. So it's quite amazing just the life experiences that have put me in the situation and position that I'm in now, and I can enjoy it. Whereas 10 years ago, I would have been eating, sleeping, breathing cricket balls if I was in this position.
Clearly, this is a hypothetical question, and I'm glad it's a hypothetical question. But if that call hadn't come,
yeah,
do you think you would have walked away from your cricket career with a bunch of regrets?
Some. I mean, no, I wouldn't have actually, because I had given it, you couldn't say it up to that point, I hadn't given it anything. I would have had a bit of a chip on my, I would have walked away with a chip on my shoulder, not regrets. Mm-hmm. I think the only thing I did wrong in the early part of my career was try too hard. And that's not a bad thing. I had a chip on my shoulder because of the finger injury at that point, because when that happened, I was flying. I was playing for Australia. I was confident. My skill was getting better all the time. And then that happened. And that was kind of the start of it, of the negative stuff and the fact that I didn't play for 2 years and I kind of just lost my way mentally. I remember playing games actually physically scared because I thought if I get hit again here on the same spot, I'm gone. So I had that in my mind. So I would have had a chip on my shoulder about playing in that game for what was it? It was like an exhibition game. That would have grinded me if I didn't play for Australia again because of that.
Would you, I have no agenda with this question, would you have had personal animosity? It was Dirk Nannis, right, who bowled the ball that broke your finger.
Yeah.
Would you have, like, cursed his name?
No, not at all. I never, you know, even when people ask about it now and they bring it up and I'm like, oh, yeah, it was Dirk. You know, it's not even something that I think about who it was. It was just the fact that it was...
They weren't going to find a basement at your house full of Dirk.
No, not at all. Like, Dirk's a lovely man. And, you know, he was one of those interesting fast bowlers that I actually kind of didn't mind facing because I knew he was such a nice bloke that he didn't want to hurt you. Whereas there's others where it's like, I think this bloke's actually trying to kill me. Whereas Dirk had sort of hit you and ask if you were okay, which was, it didn't make it any better, but it kind of made it a nicer way of getting hit. But yeah, I would have been upset about the fact that I played in an exhibition game and I was mic'd up at the time. Like there was lots of little things that I'd never done before and I did it because we were trying to, I suppose, bring fans closer to the game and stuff like that. And was I concentrating on that or was I watching the ball? Yeah, there was just little things like that.
Well, it's lucky it's a hypothetical question anyway. Yeah. Don't have to know what the answer to that one is, so that's good.
But again, the time off and the hard work and the, you know, I ended up having 7 operations on my finger, so the resilience that I was able to build through that time again at the time, absolutely hated. And now it's like, oh, that's why it happened. So again, it's become a real positive, and again, something that I can now help with my younger teammates in Tassie who are going through, you know, we've got bowlers that have got stress fractures and batters now that have got broken fingers, and, you know, my experiences through that period of my life and how I rehabbed it, or how long it took, or whether you have surgery. I think I've now got, you know, some real experiences to share with those guys and help them through similar things.
Family's been a big theme of this chat, and both, you know, the family that you've come from, but also the family of your own that you've created. Do you have a family philosophy? Do you have a parenting philosophy? Do you have, something that you really want to instill in your kids?
Not really. I just want my kids to be happy. Like, we're probably now, because of what's happened, again, in a more fortunate situation than we would have been. So I just want them to be, you know, nice kids that are well-mannered. Like, I just want them to be happy, to be honest, mate. Like, I'm not, I haven't got huge plans for them. I do get very excited now. My two-year-old gets the footy out and has a kick, and he's starting to play a bit of cricket, and I love that. But, as long as they're happy, I mean, what I want to do is provide a really good life for them. And again, since what's happened, we're probably in a position now where I can. So that's a really nice peace of mind that my kids will be pretty well looked after. But I don't want them to grow up and be, I don't want them to take anything for granted, that's for sure. But yeah, but I want them to be happy and live a good life. So that's kind of what's driving me now to stay fit and keep working and keep trying to improve even at sort of 35, 36.
So how do you improve at 35 or 36? Because as a cricketer, you know, you can still play for, you know, a few more years, but the idea of improving still at that age is interesting to me. So how do you improve?
Well, I think you're always got to be looking to improve, because in professional sports these days, there's so much footage, there's so many ways for people to look at what you do and then be able to counter it. So for me, it's, I've made some changes this year to the way I bat from a technical point of view that I think will make me so a better player on the front foot, say, because I'm more a back foot player. I like to play the pull shot and I like to play the cut shot. But once teams know that, they just pitch it up. So I can't score as freely as I would like. So I'm trying to get better on the front foot so I can then, if they pitch the ball up early this Indian series and I smack one back down the ground, they'll go, Jesus, didn't know he did that. So again, it's always having something to counter their plan with. And I just like improving. Like, don't we all? I like trying to figure out how can I do something better. Even with wicketkeeping, I've got three really basic things that I do every single time I wicketkeep. But around those basics, I can do different drills and different movements and all sorts of things that can make me a better player than I was yesterday. So the moment, I've always said to my wife and to the coaches here in Tasmania, the moment I'm not looking to improve is the moment I won't play.
You always hear about Ricky Ponting, I think, you know, it was, who would say, watch the ball three times. That was his little mantra as the bowler was coming in. I think once at the top of the run, once in the middle, and once as the ball was about to be bowled, he'd just say to himself, watch the ball.
Yeah.
Do you have something like that as a wicket keeper that has to get you back into, like, when is the moment that you start absolutely concentrating on that ball that's coming down?
Basically when they turn around. So I have my thinking time in between, and and it's still not perfect. Occasionally it happens. I like to be sort of thinking about my fields and where we're going to do something. And the moment he turns around is the moment I forget the captaincy and go into wicketkeeper mode. And my three cues for wicketkeeping are my body height, having my hands out in front, and the last one is head to the ball, which again for Ricky is like watch the ball. Mine is like head. So for me, from a wicketkeeper, I'm trying to get my head to the line of the ball. So if it's leg side, I'm trying to. And what I found is if I think about my head and not my feet move the perfect amount. Whereas when I always used to think about my footwork, it just didn't work for me. So everyone's slightly different, but for me, it's body height, hands out in front, head to the ball. And they are I say those things, three things every single ball when I squat down.
What's your nightmare as a wicketkeeper? Like, what is there a specific ball or a specific scenario?
I get these moments in the middle, particularly when I'm keeping to Starkey, because he bowls very fast. But and you see it a lot more in England, but we get it a bit more in Australia. But Starkey's very good at it. And that's when the ball wobbles, or we call it wobble. It's probably more swing, dip. It can rise. I don't know how it happens. But, like, I can get a ball and might get to a metre away from me and it just starts to veer up or it starts to veer down or left or right. And I've caught a few balls off Starkey a few times and I'm just like... Again, it amazes you that a ball can be coming at 150 plus Ks and then when it gets about a metre away from you, it just veers up and right and you catch it. And I think... honestly, catch balls sometimes. And I think, how did I catch that? I have no idea how I caught that. But then I have this image of that hitting me flush in the face. That is my nightmare. Because I'm like, that's, even though I'm standing back, that ball's travelling at 155 kilometres if it's Starkey sometimes. And they do, I've seen some swing that way and I'm clean miss them because it just go. And I think, had that have swung the other way and I've clean missed it, that's hit me right in the teeth. And so I kind of cringe a bit. I just have these moments and I try and just think of something else and concentrate on the next ball. But that's my wicket-keeping fear. I hate that feeling. And as I said, I get real cringe sort of feeling when I think about it.
Do you have the opposite to that? Do you have a moment that you can identify as, is there that one perfect moment of keeping wickets that you remember?
Yeah, again, that's when you're in that little zone. Like I feel like at times with Nathan Lyon in particular, when I get into rhythm with him, and again, it doesn't just happen because... It happens. We go into a test match or the training before test match. We'll go maybe sometimes an hour before other people and he might bowl me 20 or 30 balls. And I just get used to his action. I get used to the rhythm. I get used to the when he's really trying to bowl a big off spinner, how that looks through the air or if he's trying to push one through a bit quicker and not spin or trying to bowl a top spinner that bounces a bit more. And at times in test matches when I think people look and go, geez, that looks hard because it's spinning miles. And that for me is like the sweet spot because I just get into this little thing where it's like just before the ball bounces, I feel like sometimes I know that's going to spin a lot or that's not. I can almost see it before it pitches. I can't put my finger on, apart from, again, spending a lot of time with him and getting into rhythm with him. But there is no better feeling than that moment. It just seems to, everything just seems to just happen. And I feel like, as I said, I can see it just before it happens.
Are you good at concentrating in real life? Because like, I mean, obviously wicket keeping to me, it's incredible concentration. Do you have that same power of concentration in doing other things in your life?
No, only if I'm very good at most things that I'm passionate about. If not, my wife hates it because I can't even listen to one song. Like I don't get to the end of the song without going on to the next one. Whereas she likes to sit and just like listen to an album or, you know, I'm like, who does that anymore? I'm just like, right, yeah, good song. I've heard the chorus a few times. Next. That's kind of how I am with everything else, bar cricket or you know, most sports things. Or if I'm interested in something outside, then I get right into it. But otherwise, I'm pretty, concentration isn't my strength.
So what is the thing that you are right into outside cricket at the moment?
Well, at the moment, myself, George Bailey, and Nick Riewoldt are actually starting up some gyms down here in Tasmania. So that's taking up a bit of my spare time. It's called Body Fit Training, which is, it's on the mainland quite a bit, but we've just taken sort of, Tasmania, basically. So we're looking for sites at the moment, looking for staff. It's interesting. It's something different. And again, at the moment, it's giving me time to come home and not worry about cricket because I actually have to do something. I might need something done by Friday or by Thursday. So I need to force myself away, and that's been another good thing for it.
And so are you good in the gym? Are you a person who went to that physical side of things reasonably easily?
Yeah, I always enjoyed it. I actually find sometimes, which is probably a good thing, that cricket actually gets in the way of it. I kind of am one stage looking to forward to when I finish because I wonder how fit can I get. Whereas at the moment, I'm like, no, you can't go and do that today because you've got a wicket keep for your test match tomorrow. So just chill. I find like I want to do more, but I like to feel fresh, obviously, when I walk on the field to play.
So it's very impossible to predict the future, as you've proven in your life, but also as the world has proven to us very much in the last 12 months or so. But where is Tim Payne in 10 years from now?
Yeah, again, it's a really good question. I think, again, what I found has changed a lot is since I've become the Test captain, a lot of different doors have opened, and there is a lot more, there's certainly a lot more opportunities post-cricket than I would have had, 3 years ago, which is great in one respect. But again, my passion has always been cricket. I think I'll take a couple of years probably off, and I've got the gyms, I've got a few other things that I'll probably go and concentrate my time into, just to get away from cricket or to get away from the teams that I've actually played in, because I've got friendships and whatever. And then I think when the time's right, I'll look to come back in, whether that's coaching, whether that's in high performance. I'm not too sure, but certainly cricket and sport is my passion, my number one passion. And I think I'm always going to want to crave being in that team environment. So, I think something along those lines, maybe some commentary, which I've already started to do again, which is a good way for someone, I think, who wants to step away from the playing group a bit, but be able to keep watching cricket, keep close check on the trends of 2020 and what types of players are going, for me, that'll be a good way to keep in contact with the game and where it's headed, and then be able to step into one of those roles, hopefully down the track. But apart from that, I'll just be probably Bonnie, my wife, will be at work, and I might have a few years at home looking after the kids.
Well, that sounds all right.
Yeah, it does. Sounds so great.
Well, we'll finish up soon, but I've got some standard questions I always ask on this show, so yep. I'm going to get to those if you don't mind.
No problem.
So we'll jump in the deep end. What do you think happens when we die?
I like to think we go to another place somewhere. I like the idea of sort of catching up with people again somewhere else for me.
Who is it that you most look forward to catching up to in that other place?
Quite fortunate at the moment.
You don't need to kill someone off.
No.
To kill someone off for the sake of this.
No, I've actually been really fortunate. I'd probably say at the moment, it was 2 years ago, my wife's dad passed away, and that was quite unexpected. So, I look forward to seeing him, but we've obviously had two little kids since then, which he hasn't got to see. So I would like to hope that in the next life he gets to meet them and spend a lot more time with them.
Did you ever have any specific religion in your life? Were you raised with a religion?
Yeah,
or anything
no,
like?
No, not at all. Not sure why. I think probably just because my parents did, and it wasn't passed on by their parents. So, tends to be sort of how it works. Probably the only religion I've had is sport, to be fair. It's been, and I've got a very sporting family, both my mum and dad's side. So, but yeah, no, I haven't.
Well, I'm always fascinated by people's sporting idols just because you're a sports person, as you said, you're also a fan of sports. Yeah. What athletes did you admire?
My first one, which is people find quite funny, but my first sporting idol was actually Warwick Capper.
Right. Because you were also an individual. No, that was Mark Jacko.
Yeah.
What are you doing? What was Warwick Capper? Sydney Swans? Warwick
Sydney
Capper?
Brisbane Bears.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why. I think when I was young, I had a bit of a little blonde mullet, so maybe that. And obviously then he used to take hangers, and that's what I used to love watching that. And I haven't turned out that way, but I kind of used to love his carry-on. It used to draw me in. It was a performance. It was theatre. So I used to absolutely love Warwick Capper. And then it went to from a cricket point of view, it's always been either Booney or Ricky, and they are my two guys that, if obviously the obvious connection is Tasmania, and maybe I could sort of see the fact, because as I said, my dream was always to do that, so I could see that you know two boys from Launceston could do it, then there was a pathway for me to sort of follow. So if Ricky or Booney were batting in a test match when I was a kid, I was absolutely glued to it for every ball.
It's a great example of how representation matters. If you can see it, you can be it.
Yeah, absolutely.
That idea that, well, not just you, but the fact that Matthew Wade and yourself were essentially, you know, in the same neighbourhood.
Absolutely.
Growing up there.
Yeah.
Like, both imagine that, you know, the two of you now playing for Australia in the Test team together would have sprung out of the idea that you saw Booney or Ricky Ponting playing
absolutely.
Those games.
And we, I remember playing at Ashes Test with Wade in England, and I remember saying to him at one stage, like, we were batting together, I said, who would have thought this then when we were playing in my backyard or Wade's cousin's backyard with a taped up tennis ball? Like, it's just extraordinary. And again, like, one of the things I've started to be a bit bigger on is our Test players playing more state cricket, and our state cricketers playing more club cricket, because again, I remember being, you might not know them, some, if you're big cricket fans you will, but when I was 14, 15, 16 playing in my A grade team for the first year, we used to have Jamie Cox and Dean Hills, who were the two opening batters for Tasmania, and they played at university. And I'll never forget the day that I got picked. I used to get dropped out of the team when they came back, and I'll never forget the first time I got picked and they were in it, and I walked into the change room, my dad had dropped me off, and there's Jamie Cox and there's Dean Hills, and they were both sponsored by Grey Nichols, and they had all their bats out, and I was just like, this was like Christmas Day. I didn't want the game to finish, I didn't want the day to finish. It was just, and now in a really strange way, I love being that guy. I love going into my change rooms at university and young guys going, oh, it's Tim Payne. Oh, I find it weird and funny because it's me, and I never thought I'd be in that situation. But I also take great pride in it and try to play as much grade cricket as I can, because, like you said, if you can see it, you can touch it, you can sort of identify with it, and I think that's where your dreams start. So for me to be inspiring a young cricketer at university is something that's really important, because that's what happened to me.
If you could be naturally gifted, and I'm not talking about what sport could you play.
Yeah.
I'm literally saying I have a magic wand and I can give you the ability to, you know, represent your country or represent the highest level at any sport in the world.
Yeah.
What would you love, other sport would you love to be able to play at that level?
There's probably two answers. I think financially it would be probably basketball. In the NBA. But I think for any Australian kid, and most cricketers want to be footballers. And I think most footballers in Australia want to be cricketers. That's sort of been what I've learned the last couple of years, because we meet a few of the AFL players and they love their cricket, and we're exactly the same. Like, we're so sore. Oh, geez, we can't do running today, or we can't do whatever. You get the footy out, cricketers will run for days. We love it. So, if you could pack a few kilos on me, make me a little bit quicker, then I think I could float across the half-forward line of an AFL team.
Okay, I'll take my magic wand out again, and I can give you any skill in the world outside sport now.
Yeah.
You need to – you can just have any skill. Don't need to work for it. Magic wand, what skill would you love to possess?
Ooh. These have never been my strength, these ones, because I get stuck between about 20 things. Honestly, I would love to be like an unbelievably good singer. Because again, I feel like the way music and someone's song makes you feel and can change a mood or set a mood, I think is amazing. And yeah, I've been to a few things or watched a few things on telly, and when like an unbelievable voice comes on, everyone just stops and is like, wow. I think I'd like to be like just an unbelievably good singer.
What music do you like? What music do you actually listen to?
Well,
the whole
at the
song
moment,
rather than skip through,
there's only one artist.
Yeah.
In the world, actually, at the moment, that I can put on a Spotify and it could pretty much come from any one of their albums, and I would happily sit through it. And that's Ed Sheeran.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I
just like his vibe, and he's it's kind of cool, but it's kind of relaxed, and he's obviously extremely talented, and I love the fact that he's one of the, you know, he writes his own stuff and writes a lot of it. I find that amazing that he can keep producing songs. Like, how does that's not a bad skill, actually, writing songs.
That's good.
You're
Ed Sheeran. You get to sing and write songs and play guitar like him. You get the whole thing.
That'll
right?
do.
It's fine.
That'll do.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it. I'd like to be him. I don't know. He's the only one. Otherwise, I'm next. Next song. But
when people speak about you behind your back, what do you hope they're saying?
I hope they think I haven't changed. yeah, I think they someone who's pretty relatable, pretty laid back, honest, and trustworthy. I think that would be pretty much it. We actually had a kid, it's funny, debut for Tasmania not long ago, and we had to say, our coach got us to just say a few things about him, and he wrote them on the board. And same thing, I remember walking out of there thinking, I actually said to him, Nathan Ellis, his name is, keep an eye on him, he'll probably go reasonably well. But our coach actually said, tell you what, Ellie, if someone said that about my son, I'd be absolutely rapt. That was a really cool moment, actually. It wasn't behind his back, but it was like we got to do it the day before, and he got told, like, the morning of his first game, this is what your teammates think about you. And it was all those things, hard-working, discipline, great bloke, great team man. Like, it was just a list of... It was like he wrote it himself. it's actually a cool exercise to do sometimes in a group. But, yeah, that would probably be mine.
Okay, so big summer of cricket, obviously, in Australia. It's been a very interesting year in regard to people being able to go and watch games.
Yeah.
Travel being incredibly limited, life in a bubble, all these different things. What's COVID's effect on cricket, and how has it changed the way that you guys have had to approach it?
Well, honestly, I think in the long run, it will actually be a good thing. I think potentially it got too big. There was too much happening. There's so many people involved in it. I think one of the great things we're going to have to do is learn to be able to do more with less. People are going to have to help other people a bit more. And you're going to have to do things together. So I think it's going to build better teams. It's going to build closer friendships, better understanding of each other, better understanding of team, and the fact that, if I help my teammates get better, then we're all getting better. And that's... I think the really exciting things, of cricket and sport in general going forward. And I think for us in the Australian cricket team, where we're talking about it now, is being able to adapt and be the first to adapt and embrace it and enjoy it. Don't fight it. Don't sook about it. Don't whinge. It is what it is. Let's make the best of the situation. And, we speak about that a lot. The first cricket team we talk about, obviously, who adapts to the new surroundings and how it is and keeps moving forward, they'll be the best team.
Final question, Tim. Thank you so much for this, by the way. I'm very, very much enjoyed this whole chat. I want to ask you this question because I ask it of everybody.
Yeah.
You don't need to... There's no correct answer.
Yeah.
And you don't need to do anything like go back and kill baby Hitler or fix major things that have happened in the world. But I have a time machine and I have a return trip.
Yeah.
And you can go anywhere in the world. You can go in the future. You can go in the past. You can go to a moment in your own life and revisit it.
Yeah.
Give yourself some advice. I don't care what you do with it.
Yeah.
But you have to use it. One round trip. Where do you go?
Look, I'll say this. Only because I have to use it, I'll go back to tomorrow and I'll do tomorrow. I'll start again because I honestly feel like there's nothing that I would change in the end. Like everything that's been shitty that's happened to me has happened in the end for a reason or has actually become a strength or a growth area for me. So... I've said this to someone the other day. I actually wouldn't change a thing. So because you're making me take the trip, I'd go back to tomorrow and I'd do that again. But apart from that, yeah, I'm a kid who grew up in Australia wanting to play for his country. I've become the Australian Test captain when 3 years ago I was about to quit. I've got a beautiful family and kids and even my childhood was, you couldn't complain. I grew up in a suburb called Lauderdale, lived on the beach, had plenty of mates, played backyard cricket and footy. I've had a bloody good life. And as I said, the tough moments have become real lessons for me or areas where I've got better or areas that I've been able to use the experience from now for what confronts me day to day in my new job. So I see myself as very fortunate.
Well, what a great way to end. Thank you so much for joining this today, mate. I wish the Australians and yourself personally all the best of luck for the upcoming summer of cricket. I'm very excited to see you know, how we go against India.
Yeah, it's going to be good.
One of those, like, you know, super teams. But I also am like you, that I'm glad that Virat Kohli is going. So
absolutely. Let's not lie about it.
Thanks, mate.
No worries. Thanks for having me.